It was to be the consultant physician's last visit, and Dalgliesh suspected that neither of them regretted it. Arrogance and patronage on one side, and weakness, gratitude and dependence on the other, being no foundation for a satisfactory adult relationship, however transitory. He came into Dalgliesh's small hospital room, preceded by Sister, attended by his acolytes, already dressed for the fashionable wedding which he was to grace as a guest later that morning. He could have been the bridegroom, except that he sported a red rose instead of the customary carnation. Both he and the flower looked as if they had been bought and burnished to a peak of artificial perfection, gift-wrapped in invisible foil, and immune to the chance winds, frosts, and ungentle fingers which could mar more vulnerable perfections. As a final touch, he and the flower had both been lightly sprayed with an expensive scent, presumably an aftershave lotion. Dalgliesh could detect it above the hospital smell of cabbage and ether to which his nose had become so inured during the past weeks that it now hardly registered on the senses. The attendant medical students grouped themselves round the bed. With their long hair and short white coats, they looked like a gaggle of slightly disreputable bridesmaids. Dalgliesh was stripped by Sister's skilled impersonal hands for yet another examination. The stethoscope moved, a cold disc, over his chest and back. This last examination was a formality, but the physician was, as always, thorough. Nothing he did was perfunctory. If on this occasion his original diagnosis had been wrong, his self-esteem was too secure for him to feel the need for more than a token excuse. He straightened up and said, "We've had the most recent path report, and I think we can be certain now that we've got it right. The cytology was always obscure, of course, and the diagnosis was complicated by the pneumonia. But it isn't acute leukemia. It isn't any type of leukemia. What you're recovering from, happily, is an atypical mononucleosis. I congratulate you, Commander. You had us worried." "I had you interested. You had me worried. When can I leave here?" Great man laughed and smiled at his retinue, inviting them to share his indulgence at yet one more example of the ingratitude of convalescence. Dalgliesh said quickly, "I expect you'll be wanting the bed."
"We always want more beds than we can get, but there's no great hurry. You've a long way to go yet. Still, we'll see. We'll see."
When they had left him, he lay flat on his back and let his eyes range round the 2 cubic feet of anaesthetized space, as if seeing the room for the first time. The washbasin with its elbow-operated taps, the neat functional bedside table with its covered water jug, the 2 vinyl-covered visitor's chairs, the earphones curled above his head, the window curtains with their inoffensive flowered pattern, the lowest denominator of taste. They were the last objects he had expected to see in life. It had seemed a meagre, impersonal place in which to die. Like a hotel room, it was designed for transients. Whether its occupants left on their own feet or sheeted on a mortuary trolley, they left nothing behind them, not even the memory of their fear, suffering, and hope. The sentence of death had been communicated, as he suspected such sentences usually were, by grave looks, a certain false heartiness, whispered consultations, a superfluity of clinical tests, and, until he had insisted, a reluctance to pronounce a diagnosis or prognosis. The sentence of life, pronounced with less sophistry when the worst days of his illness were over, had certainly produced the greater outrage. It was, he had thought, uncommonly inconsiderate, if not negligent, of his doctors to reconcile him so thoroughly to death and then change their minds. It was embarrassing now to recall with what little regret he had let slip his pleasures and preoccupations, the imminence of loss revealing them for what they were, at best only a solace, at worst a trivial squandering of time and energy. Now he had to lay hold of them again and believe that they were important, at least to himself. He doubted whether he would ever again believe them important to other people. No doubt, with returning strength, all that would look after itself. The physical life would reassert itself, given time. He would reconcile himself to living, since there was no alternative, and this perverse fit of resentment and accidie, conveniently put down to weakness, would come to believe that he had had a lucky escape. His colleagues, relieved of embarrassment, would congratulate him. Now that death had replaced sex as the great unmentionable, it had acquired its own pudency. To die when you had not yet become a nuisance, and before your friends could reasonably raise the ritual chant of happy release, was in the worst of taste.